But the critical question that you have to ask yourself was, well, was it good? I can never figure out what will be commercial, but I can tell what's good. And that's all I care about.
I'm sitting beside George Bear in New York. You actually see opportunities at a very early time.
A while back, I realized that there was an opportunity to create a little bit of a different model of art advisory than I have this idea to do a newsletter.
I mean, in this industry, everybody knows about your newsletter.
And that takes guts.
That takes a lot of guts.
To be the only one at auction to raise your hand.
You need to have people who has balls. Hello, this is Pearland Podcast. I'm here in New York again. I'm sitting beside George Bear. George, can you tell and give briefly about your journey to become who today George Bear is to the audience?
You mean my 30-second elevator speech?
Yes.
It may take 45 seconds. So I'm a child of artists. So I come to the art world from the inside growing up with, like, there's Clement Greenberg and the house. Would he leave? Can I have dinner? And hanging out with Robert Smithson, or there's Andy Warhol playing with my stuff. And I never thought I wanted to have anything to do with the art business. But in my early 20s, I went, wait a second, I don't want to do all this math and computer stuff. And I moved back to New York to live.
Where were you?
I was in grad school in the Midwest, master's in computer science. I know I'm such a techie. So, and I was fortunate enough to get a job running a nonprofit space called White Columns, which used to be called something else. And I guess I was dumb enough to take the job because they had no money. So I did that for 4 years doing all these big shows. And as a 23-year-old, it's like, okay, try this, try that, try this. And it was a golden age in New York. So you'd go to a studio, and there's this Jeff Koons guy. You'd go to a show at the Guggenheim, who's Joseph Beuys? You'd run off to Europe to see a show. It's like, who's this Polka guy? So it was a great moment to be a young person in New York, the bars, the music, the film, everything great. And then I wound up broke for the first time. So my dad said to me, what if you open an art gallery? And I went, well, that's a good idea. Not realizing that maybe you should know collectors when you open a gallery. So, which I didn't, but I knew artists. So I ran a gallery that started really small that became very big by the 90s with artists like Chris Burden, wow, and Annette Messager.
That is Warner in the Simpsons. Range of how many years?
1985 to 94.
9 years. Wow.
9 years, which is, in retrospect, a kind of a typical period that galleries operate before they close, as we get to recently. So I built a very big gallery. I expanded right when the art market went into the biggest recession of all time, 1990, and I wound up broke again. So I'm sitting there going, well, I have all this money. I have no money. What am I going to do? And I'm sitting in the shower basically one day, and I have this idea to do a newsletter. And I'm thinking, okay, well, there's no way of getting news out quickly because it would take months for Art in America to write something. So I had a meeting. Do you remember a restaurant in New York called Jerry's?
No, I don't know.
So there was a restaurant in Soho called Jerry's. It was like the commissary of the movie studios. You'd have the big stars, the extras, all that. And I went there for lunch and I met with this guy and I said, I have this idea, but I want you to write it. And we were at Jerry's and I was talking to a guy named Jerry. It was Jerry Saltz at that time. And I said, Jerry, why don't you write it? He said, this is a great idea, but you should do it yourself. So I started the Bear Fax, which had a fax machine, which maybe half your audience doesn't
that's
know.
That's right, it's called Bear Fax.
It's a play on words. So a fact versus a fax. So used to be, you know, we kid around, it was a man and a fax machine. We had subscribers. First subscriber was this young kid who was used to be an intern near me, opened a gallery near where we were. And his subscriber number one was this guy, I don't know if you've heard of him, called David Zwirner.
Of course.
So David was subscriber number one. It would be me standing.
Oh, subscriber number one.
Yes, $99. First check came from David Zwirner, like $99. It's like, wow, I can eat this week. It was great. And I would stand there with the fax machine, and I'd send them out one by one, and we had a couple hundred, and then a few more, and it became kind of a big deal.
In a range of how long, you have like 1,000 subscribers.
But we only have 1,000 subscribers now, so I would say it was in the hundreds.
The hundreds.
And then it would grow, and the price would go up, and I think by this point, a lot of people don't know that I had a gallery or that I've been an art advisor at the same time for the last 30 years. So by being in the market, I'm sure you can tell when you read the art press about what they're talking about, the art business, and you're going, well, that's not exactly it. So by being in the art market, I like to say I can write about the art market in a completely different way because I've done the deals and I work with the major dealers and collectors and all that. So that was that 30 seconds?
A little bit more. You know, I'm very curious about your experience as a galleries at the time between 80s to 90s. How was America like, and you 9 years, you actually represent a lot of great artists.
They weren't very commercial at the time. And there were other artists that were very popular with waiting lists of 100 people you probably don't even know. So it was a much smaller art world.
Oh, yeah. The art world really grown enormously is during the 2000s, right?
Exactly. It's like we knew all the collectors either personally or by reputation at that point. So it was, I don't know, 5% the size. At that
5% the size, wow.
And I would say that come around 1990, that two of the biggest collectors in the world, and for Soho and people my generation, their two big best clients both died in the same year. One was Thomas Amann, and he was a huge supporter of many galleries and younger artists, aside from doing his masterpieces. And there's a Swedish guy named Fredrik Ruse, who was everybody's biggest client, including mine. And so you have both of them out of the scene at the same time. It'd be like, imagine that Steve Cohen and Mitch Rales were two of the only 10 collectors in the world, and they both stopped collecting art now. Oh, that would be catastrophic. Yeah. But right now there's hundreds of people. Back then it was much smaller.
Wow.
In my OG days.
This is really pretty amazing experience. So you actually witness the growth of the American art market.
Completely, with other recessions and with a different sense of the market becoming more dominant than the art.
Did you ever expect it? Barefaxed becomes an industry must read newsletter.
No. And in a sense, I compare like representing Chris Burton, a great artist, and getting shows for him around the world, placing pieces in museums was much more important than writing a newsletter that says, you know, Pearl Am is now represented by Josh Baer or who bought this or that. But it's become an important thing that I have to recognize at the same time. So it's a little bit embarrassing because gets a lot of attention.
Yes.
But
it's must read newspaper, as I said. It's the industry. And in this industry, everybody knows about your newsletter.
Which is great because then it has a certain amount of credibility and power. And we'll get to it later, I hope. And we're leveraging the core newsletter into other products. We're on this podcast. We have a pretty good podcast ourselves, we like to think.
Oh, I have to subscribe to your podcast.
The Barefax podcast. It's been going a year. And all those things grow out of what we do as a newsletter and what I do as an art advisor, reformed art dealer.
Tell us more about your Barefax collector's circle.
So it starts a little bit with remember when Sotheby's bought the art agency partners, Amy Capilazzo, Alan Schwartzman, and they paid them $85
million. Yes.
Which was a crazy amount
of money.
But they recognized something that was interesting. They recognized that many of their clients at Sotheby's had need a need for advisory service that went beyond just, should I buy this at Sotheby's? Should I buy that at Sotheby's? They recognized the demand for knowledge and access, which is what we do around the world. Their only problem was they had no independence. So a while back, I realized that there was an opportunity to create a little bit of a different model of art advisory that's different than my personal clients, some of whom buy things for eight figures, that needs sort of like art advisor on demand, it started with. Mm-mm. Same way, if you're wealthy, you might have, you know, concierge medical service where you've got access to a team. And I was like, what if we created a product that was a membership that gave access to me as an advisor and information? And I realized after a while that first I thought, well, let's make this for young collectors. And I thought, well, wait a second. What does young mean? And especially spending a lot of time in Asia, a lot of new collectors aren't necessarily young.
Exactly.
But they're young at spirit. I said, well, let's expand that to, like, can we provide them access and knowledge to transactions through us or on their own? And then we've got in so far as, like, can we create a community for them to, like, relate to each other as they're traveling? And that's why we call it a circle. And we launched it, I don't know, officially 4 or 5 months ago. And I think it's a scalable product in the same way that Sotheby's had this idea that there are a lot of people that could benefit from this service. And the more we have, actually, the better it gets.
Yes, because people like social life and they like to meet each other. They like community.
Well, it's beyond that. It's like I was comparing the social community of, like, the young patrons groups. And my gallery, I organized the young patrons of the Israel Museum. I worked with the young patrons of the new museum, and they were great. They were great for me to meet people, but they were localized to one place. And at MoMA, particularly, it's a social thing. And I realized, in fact, that the people I was trying to reach weren't interested so much in the social as learning. So we've always seen it as an educational platform. And the way to grow it is by teaching people. So it's a community, yes, but not a community to go have a cocktail and meet your future husband. It's a community of like-minded people.
Yeah. And how about your BFXed podcast? What is it about? Who do you interview?
What's interesting lately is that we've been interviewing artists, and we've been able to talk to them about the business, because a lot of artists shy away from that. Next week is with Takashi Murakami, and then we did one with Alicia Quadra, who is, like, very interesting artist. But we've had I'm blanking on all the podcasts. We did Jerry Saltz, Jeff Poe gave probably the most popular one we did was immediately after he stepped out of Lemon Poe, he did a podcast with us.
Oh, Jeff.
Jeff, and he was great. And we've done about a dozen of them. We did UC, Bill Cannon when he left Christie's, his first interview. And it's a way, the same way as you're able to get people to be comfortable with you. Because they're not live streamed, there's a chance to rephrase.
Yeah, you can do the post-word
production. Yeah, like, oops, I did something stupid. Can we redo it? And I think I'm able to get people to be more comfortable talking than they might with a normal journalist.
So now, I mean, you have been in the art world for so many years, and you've been in Asia and globally. What are you seeing? What is the dynamic changes since 2000.
Well, I'll go back further. It's like the first time I went to Asia on business was around 1990. And one of my artists had a show in Tokyo, sponsored by the family of a famous fashion house. And back then, the idea of being an art dealer was kind of the lowest form of human life.
Oh, really?
Not well respected.
In 1990s, in Japan.
1990 was like artists were respected, but the notion of a gallerist, it's like, oh, man, like, you know, garbage collector, gallerist. And I remember being there on, it was the opening night of the show, and I traveled from America, and like, it's a big deal. And I paid my own way, and the artist is doing big show, 20 works, and they're being super nice. And I asked them if there was somebody I knew, a big art dealer up to me in town, if they could come to the dinner after the opening. They go, oh, no, no art dealers allowed at opening dinner. None, they can't go. No art dealers, bad. So I went, okay. I remember, I thought, well, that meant me. So I remember going back to my hotel room, and I was shedding a tear or two. You know, you fly 7,000 miles at your expense, and like you go out and buy Kentucky Fried Chicken or something. You're sitting there, and the next day at the press thing, and they go, where were you, Josh? And I'm like, but you told me no art dealers are allowed. And they said, we didn't mean you. So that was they meant like anybody else.
Okay.
So my view was not a very well-respected community back then. So now it's...
Has it been changed yet?
30 years later, I would say certainly art dealers are probably more respected in the West than artists even. I mean, they're almost at the top of the chain. It's like art dealer, collector, artist. And then...
Depending on how big the artist is. If the artist is big, then, you know.
Yeah, but still Larry Gagosian's kind of on top. And even, you know, all his others are sort of below him. And it's certainly in the West, highly respected. And even in 30 years ago, it was very respected in the West. So that's sort of changed. I would say in Japan, a little less so. But, and just to finish this thought, I would say art advisory is a very new thing in Asia.
Oh, and, completely new. Oh, yes. Let's talk about your art advisory service, because you have you started with a gallery and then you maintain your art advisory, right?
So art advisory, when I started in the gallery, there were two art advisors kind of in the world, at least in New York. So two. And now everybody who's got a pair of high heels or knows a rich person is an art advisor. It's like there's no licensing. And there's somebody, I think it was maybe Jerry Gagosian, came up with the term gmail.com art advisor. And there's a lot of truth to that. So listen, there's a zillion of us there. And there are about 20 or 40 of them in the West that are really, we do 90% of the business, that are really well respected. And we can come back to that. But in Asia, it's still a very new.
Very new. And a lot of advisors, they don't even know what they're talking about.
Right.
They have no knowledge. They have no experience.
And there's a couple of them that are quite good. But
of course they have.
But not many. And I think it's an impediment to the growth of the business on a more rigorous scale. And that's something that even the billionaires there think, well, they can have 10 of them or 20 of them. And it's kind of like it's not helping them. So that's something that we've recognized that we think is a growth opportunity for us, is to provide advisory for people there. For instance, when I was there in March, we ran into somebody through one of my colleagues, and half my team is Asian, and somebody that she knew, and a banker from Beijing. And we ran into her. She came to one of our events, and she said, well, she was thinking of buying a Louis Bourgeois from Hauser & Worth. What do we think? Mm. And it came out that as of 2 weeks before, she'd never heard of Louis Bourgeois, nor had she ever heard of Hauser & Worth.
So how did she...
And she bought this drawing for $400,000. So she's a very intelligent woman, you know, educated in the West, but it's like, this is new. So that's a pretty great opportunity to like try to have a conversation with, like, which Louise Bourgeois? Have you seen all the ones they have at all their galleries? So I think we're only at the beginning of developing a more sophisticated market.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So when did you enter the Chinese market then?
Well, I don't think of it as the Chinese market. I think of it as Asia as a whole. And I think of it in global terms, not just local terms.
But the thing is, it was very different from, a Korean is a much more sophisticated market than that.
Absolutely.
Than the Chinese market.
Yes.
Or even Japan is really, really very, very different.
And we recognize that. But I was, you know, listen, I'm older. I'm a little late to the game. I always thought, like, well, I could just show up at Art Basel Hong Kong and say, here I am, you know, this, you know, white-haired guy from New York, you know, all this Jewish guy with an art advisory and like, hey, Chinese billionaire, here I am. Let's start working. I kind of recognize that's not how things work. Okay. So I sort of on the sideline. And then what happened was that I hired somebody who was quite experienced to work with us. And she's a partner in it. And she was born in mainland China. She'd been at 18. She had her own TV show on national TV as a business show. She went to Berkeley. She became an investment banker. She helped start Comps at Christie's in Hong Kong. When Hauser and Worth and Goshen came to Hong Kong, she introduced them around Asia. And then she sort of had a kid and stepped back from business. And I met her actually through somebody in Hong Kong. And we hit it off and she decided to go back in a full-time way into work. So now I have this powerhouse person. And through her, another teammate in Shanghai, it's like, now I can come because she knows who's who and what's what. So I like to say, you know, if you've got a, you know, the round peg square hole thing.
Yeah.
So if you got a square hole and you go out in the world looking for a square peg, it's not going to work. And you find a round peg, that doesn't work. It's like, I found the peg, now create the hole. So now we have great opportunity to understand what's going on because, listen, it's presumptuous for me to understand all these histories and walk in like, I know better, you should do it my way. And people don't react well
to
that.
No.
And I realized, well, I have to come in with a little bit more humility, even though I've spent 45 years professionally and since age 4 being around it, I know a lot. But if I come in with that attitude, that's not a good way. People don't like that. And it's presumptuous. And it's xenophobic, that West beast East. So it's like, I waited. And now the opportunity did present itself.
You waited for how long?
Until two years ago. Okay. So I waited till I waited for the square peg. And if I was 25, I would have started like, I'll just come and try to do it. And if I was 25 now, I'd be going to India saying,
yes,
like,
absolutely.
That's an open, you know, that's going to be the second richest, you know, country in the world by the end of the century. And it's billion plus people and they don't know squat, most of them. That's the greatest opportunity if you've got 10, 20, 30 years to wait for that to happen. I'm 68, I don't have that time, but.
So you actually see opportunities at a very early time that you actually have a lot of strategy to build your business.
We have a lot of strategy. I tell everybody, it's like everything we have to do, all of us, is you have to be really deliberate. Why am I sending that email? Why are we choosing this guest? Why are I presenting this work of art? It's like we move fast because we have all this experience, but you have to move carefully.
So how do you see digital, social media, technology? You study computer science, right? How do you see technology impact this art market?
Well, that's a many part question. So back in the OG days, to sell art, you had to have a photographer come in for thousands of dollars, and then you'd have these little slides, and if you had money, you'd have these big positive. Yes, and it's like, and when you sent one out to a collector in California, it's like, well, it's going to take time for them to get there. I hope they return it. Are they going to like it? It looks good there. Wait for them to phone you. Things move very slowly. So right now with digital imagery, the communication process is virtually instantaneous. So it's a huge business advantage for putting information out. Imagine waiting for, it's my last slide of that painting. Do I send it to this guy in Cincinnati? He may not buy the painting. Then I don't get the slide back. How do I show that? And it was a huge expense. Now you have a digital camera
and everything goes.
That technology is really highly efficient for business and email and all that. I mean, it's not the same as looking at art, but you have that. Now, I guess you were getting at NFTs, and it's like, okay, that's a new medium. It's like video. I mean, I remember in 1986, I sold a video installation. I think it might have been the first one ever sold almost to a museum in the whole country. I mean, it's like, oh my God, we sold a Dara Birnbaum to SF MoMA and one to the Israel Museum for like $5,000.
Wow, so at that time.
That was a miracle. Now, you know, to some degree, you have Nam June Paik.
Nam June Paik.
Wow. Was also, you know, I wouldn't think of him exactly the same way, but it was really radical. So we're now well past that. Video installations and all that. So NFTs, it's like, it's not interesting when it's just a JPEG on your phone, but there's something there. We're not quite there, but it's like.
Do you think NFT would resurrect? NFT's market is completely gone.
Well, I think we're at the reboot. So today we do these city guides. It's another product we did. We've done them on Hong Kong last year. Tokyo, we just released one on the metaverse. And people kind of shocked even in the...
I love that metaverse.
So we've done them on cities. So, you know, Seoul, Hong Kong. We're going to do more. And I said to my team a few months ago when we're planning, I said, I want to do one on the metaverse as a location. And I said, and I've already seen it today. It just came out a few hours ago. People are going to be, the Bear Facts is interested in NFTs. And we have all these people from these different platforms. I thought, yeah, we should show that we're open to that as a possibility. And sort of framed it, I think it's NFT 2.0. Mm. So 1.0 was what was going. And 1.1 became NFT as Beanie Baby. Remember, or swatches where, you know, Beanie Baby, the right one could be, or Bored Ape for $1 million. I mean, that's just.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got friends who've paid that, but they're fools on this one. And, you know, fortunately.
But today, Bored Apes weren't worth anything.
Right. And they're still trading at over $1 million. So it's crazy. So that's just an avatar on your phone. I mean, it's like, it's kind of ridiculous.
But that's, I thought that's something that you use to just. Trading, making money, you know?
Yeah, but it was only about money.
Yeah, exactly. It's only about money.
And that crashed. So what's left after that are people who are serious about doing them. And that could become interesting again.
I think metaverse will always last. I mean, NFT is another story.
I just see it as part of that whole thing. I think the blockchain is ridiculous for art, and no one really collects art in a serious way. Wants their information on the cloud, and they want to hold back on that. But it's like, at the same time, you know, I happen to be a fan of Beeple now, and I've gone to his museum, and I know him, and yes, it's juvenile, but there's something there. So when I said that, I'm like, I buy into Beeple as sort of a later day Jeff Koons. And people said, oh, you drank the NFT Kool-Aid. I said, no, I drank the people Kool-Aid, not the whole world of that. I mean, are your artists making NFTs?
Yes, one artist. I did two NFT, but I realized after I did two NFT, I doesn't really understand the crypto market and how to market it. So the third one, we were working with an NFT platform, a complete different platform that they can sell and everything in LA. Unfortunately, the market crashed. So it's nothing, you know, it's at one point, all artists wanted to make NFT.
But the critical question that you have to ask yourself was, well, was it good? And I'm not very commercial, so I can never figure out what will be commercial, but I can tell what's good, and that's all I care about. And if it's good
for me, it's just a learning process. Something new, I want to learn about it. So we did it, and I realized that no, I don't know how to market this to all those crypto guys, and you need to have someone, you know, some platform who's professional enough. They understand the crypto market and how you talk to these guys, not us. So we work at one point. We're working with other people,
but there's interesting people doing things that are sort of related. Like, do you know TR Lab?
Oh yes, of course.
So they
TR
do.
Lab, yeah.
They do sophisticated things, and Audrey is like, she's a kid, but she's like, she knows what she's doing. And Zinlee Cohen, they know what they're doing. So I'm more interested in companies like that that aren't just like putting, you know, JPEGs onto phones, that are doing something. They have these learning things. It's crazy what they do, and it's really thoughtful. So I think of NFTs not so directly, the metaverse not so directly. I think about like, who's doing stuff that's really bright? So I'm like, okay, I'll look at what they do.
Let's talk back. Let's talk about your advisory again. Your advisory now, have you done, beside Asia, do you go to Middle East?
I was just talking to some people about that in the way that we reached out to Asia. That's the next place to go.
Yeah, I thought Saudi is a very interesting.
Everybody's going to Saudi. I saw that, you know, when I saw Michael Govan from a distance in Seoul, they just arrived from Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, I saw Michael there as well.
And, you know, Alan Schwartzman, who's an old dear friend, is doing big things there. I'm a little bit cautious politically of understanding is everything, you know, what's going on. So I would need to get my learning curve up before doing that. I was in the Emirates last summer. I've been there a few times. It's complex. Well, in the same way, it's like the culture of Korea and the culture of Japan versus the culture of Thailand. I mean, even the culture of Dubai versus Abu Dhabi versus Qatar, they're completely different cultures.
Completely different. And Qatar is great as well.
But it's like their history, I forget, it was in Abu Dhabi, then Qatar. One of them had like 3,000 citizens 50 years ago, and one had 400,000.
Yes.
I forget who's who, but that's completely different.
Yes.
And Sharjah versus...
Yeah, Sharjah.
You know,
the Bayou is great, Georgia.
And I was there, I don't know, 15 years ago or something when they first started.
Wow, it's very different now.
And it's complex. And if we don't have a dialogue with them, things don't change. Yeah. And there's troubling political things in America as much as there is in other parts of the world, I would say, you know, I'm being thoughtful here to not. So I see that as a place to go. What's different about the Middle East than Asia is the population. So when I was in Seoul, there were like a gazillion people at all the openings and at the art fairs, young, on their phones, calling their parents, carrying $20,000 bags. I mean, there were thousands of them, tens of thousands of them, potentially hundreds of thousands. I mean, I've been to the Dubai Art Fair and they're like 20 people came in.
Yes.
And that's a different thing. And I suspect in Saudi Arabia, they're not going to be, you know, 50,000 people going to Art Basel, Riyadh with their Gucci bags. Maybe there will, but I don't see that at the moment.
But Saudi has a bigger population anyway.
It has a bigger population.
Yeah, much bigger
for population. Sure. So,
but the intense of, you know, Koreans really love art. Art they have been collecting since 1970s, and Saudi the beginning. Well, everything is at the beginning.
What's interesting there, I assume, is one of the things that I found really interesting, not so much in Asia in general, and Korea definitely has been on the contemporary modern market for 50 years.
Yes, but for a long time.
And each of those countries has their own cultural history that's thousands of years. So it's not like it's a cultural void. It's a 20th century contemporary modern cultural void. But what I discovered, particularly from mainland China and to some degree Hong Kong, is how flat their knowledge is. So I was talking to somebody whose name I won't tell you, but you would know, in Hong Kong, and they said to me, well, and they've been collecting, they were talking about their Julie Moretto and other stuff, and they said, and we were talking about Manet.
Oh, Manet, yeah.
And the woman said, well, would it be okay if I had a Manet and a Julie Moretto? I said, yes,
yes,
it would be okay. So that also got me thinking that for, and she's very sophisticated and went to school in America, but for new people, and I met some of them from mainland China, they found out about Manet the same day they found out about Basquiat. They don't have the historical education that all of us in the West had, where we learned about Rembrandt, then we learned about,
yes, yes,
you know, Goya, then we learned about, you know, Cezanne, and then Picasso, then Jackson Pollock, and then we got to Jeff Koons. They learned about it all the same day.
All the same day, yes.
And that's kind of fascinating. It's a completely different way of experiencing history.
But it's different because in the West you have this chronological of the historical, and you have museums that
MoMA
you can
see. MoMA tells that story.
Yeah.
Step by step.
And yeah, you can go to the museums and look at it. China, you don't have that.
Right, it came
right.
All at once.
And yeah.
So
you go to all the museum, and all the museum has all these different things. And also they see all the things from auction previews.
Right, but it's flat.
To use
Tom Friedminster, the world is flat for them. And it's like, it's not bad. It's just...
It's different.
Different. And so I started looking at that. And even from reading about it and meeting the people, and what I realized in the learning thing, they started to ask the right questions. And that's a real game changer too. It's like, well, what's the condition of this work? How does it fit into history? How does this work fit into all the other works of the artist? Not just like the price or that somebody else is bidding at auction. So the questions, and listen, intelligence is equal around the world. It's just a matter of the luck of the draw. If you were born in the South Sudan, or if you're born in Paris, you're just as intelligent, but you have different experiences. They have different experiences, but the learning curve is fast.
The learning curve is very brief. Is in this brief time, you have to absorb so many things. And then do you think politics does have a huge impact in the art market?
Well, are you talking about politics in the
now,
art?
Politics
in the art market?
No, politics, like now anti-China, right? There's a very huge anti-China sentiment. You look at the Chinese contemporary artwork, all down. No, I mean, in general, all the European market, all the Western Europe, American market has no interest in mainland Chinese artists.
Well, I would say I wouldn't put all mainland Chinese artists in the same pool. What I would say is when I started seeing the art coming out of smiling, communist workers.
Oh, no, those are...
That
those
wasn't are, very interesting
no,
to me.
No, those are not interesting. This is what we call the Western definition of contemporary art, which is political pop.
Yes, was, and when we saw that, yeah, I went...
I didn't even
I was that. Like, okay, bye. It's like,
no, those are political pop. This is Western definition of Chinese works. But in general, all the Chinese works is done.
But I would say, personally, I mean, I'm not there. I prefer to be expert in things and not that expert. It's like Ai Weiwei, for me, is one of the top 10 artists living
but
in the
world. But Ai Weiwei is very different. In the Chinese, we don't really consider Ai Weiwei as a Chinese artist because Ai Weiwei art is China bashing, right? So.
He's a great artist.
Yeah. And he's a great artist, but is not.
And it might be.
The Chinese artist is living
like
in
it
China.
Because I have a preconceived notion.
See, of course.
See, and like, there's the Chinese people, and then there's the Chinese government, and they're not the same. It's like, when Trump was president, I wouldn't like to think all Americans were looked at in the rest of the world as we're pro-Trump. So I try to differentiate the politics of the government. And certainly China's got a different system than we
yes.
do. So I think the issue that I see in the market is more that the money flow out of China has been repressed. And that's the bigger problem than anything
but
else.
Isn't that most collectors, they like to buy as an investment. And therefore, they look at the auction market. If the auction market... The price has gone down or the price hasn't gone up or brought in, it will affect them from buying the work.
Well,
and if in the West they are not buying, like say Chinese contemporary art, most of the work, if you look at the auction market, then it doesn't encourage people to continue to pursue.
Or it's an opportunity.
Yes, exactly. You need to have people who has balls and guts.
So if you know the concept of watch, no one wants to, what's the catch a falling knife, right? You know that.
Yes, yes.
Okay, well, I came up with something quite proud of is watch out for the catching the rising knife because that's really the dangerous one. That's like on the rise up and blah, 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 and you catch it there and holy shit, it starts to crash and you're sunk. So this is conceivably a buying opportunity to get the better examples at a lower price. And that takes guts.
That takes a lot of guts.
To be the only one at auction to raise your hand.
Yeah, you have to be.
And you have to be playing the long game.
And you have to be in confidence and everything. You have to believe.
And you have to not need the money out now.
Yeah, exactly. What do you think about, when we talk about art market sustainability, what's your comments on it?
I think you're talking largely about different factions. So the auction houses will figure out how to survive. They'll have good years, bad years. They're pivoting in what they're doing, but they're okay. Galleries, I mean, if you look back 20 years in art form and see all those ads, like a lot of those galleries, including mine, are gone. It's normal that galleries rotate out. I mean, think about restaurants. Like, I think 90% of restaurants that open are out of business within 5 years. So it doesn't mean that much. We make a big deal of somebody closing their gallery or 10 people closing. It's normal. It's somewhat Darwinian. It's hard to do that job, 100 hours a week for little pay. It's like it's hard to be great at business and at creative. So that's kind of it's normal. And then the other part is like sustainability of the artist. And it's like it's tough to be an artist, and there's millions of them.
Yes.
How do we expect to support millions of artists? There aren't that many that are great. So they're going to rotate even more quickly. I think someone did a study. They looked at the index of all the artists in Art Basel from 1 year to 10 years later, and it was probably the rotation was 90%. So this is all normal. in general. But it's, if you're that artist, that gallery, it's your whole life. So it's powerful at the same time as being, you know, you have one shot.
Right. On this note, I would like to thank you, Josh. Wonderful talking to you.
It was a pleasure to be here. You asked great questions, and we hope that your audience loves it.
I think everybody will be running after you. Sign me as your new client.
Right on.
Thank you.